Hi, and welcome back to Kylie Says. I am so excited for you all to hear today's episode because I think it's one that we do not talk about enough. And I am absolutely excited to have Rachel on the podcast. I actually first heard about her, spoke with her, engaged with her through a work event where she spoke with our sister agency and our agency about her company called Feminist Self-Defense, which she founded 10 years ago. So congratulations, that is a huge milestone. And her journey into self-defense is unique. So 16 years ago, she started training in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu at the same time that she started a master's program for women's and gender studies. And these are each obviously super niche interest areas, but they also complement each other a bit. She's also a professor and teaches women in gender study, but what she started to explore when she was going through her Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu experience and her master's program was the idea that we can think about self-defense as equality in gender and power. We feel power in our bodies, but how we feel power in society is largely based on our gender and our identity. And she realized that we could basically break the mold on how we had been taught self-defense. And one thing that I love so much about her teaching is that if you were to immediately start a self-defense class, most of the time you'll be inundated with a number of fear tactics and data points that are absolutely terrifying to hear firsthand about the prevalence of sexual assault and violence in the United States today. And what many of you may or may not know is that you are more likely to be assaulted or experience some sort of physical violence by those that you know instead of those that you don't know. And she talks about the fact that she does not ever, throughout her program, focus with her participants on those data points because her entire program is meant to facilitate a mental and physical peace with the idea that, of course, this is prevalent and may happen, but the more empowered you are to know how to respond in that situation, the better. We talked today about boundary setting and how to set both physical and mental boundaries, how to become aware of your power, and we make some really awesome synchronicities between the spiritual world and that of some of what we might find out in our day-to-day lives and some of the discomfort that we could experience being women, being smaller, being assumedly less powerful than male counterparts in certain situations, and what power looks like. We also talk about some questions to ask yourself and how your body physiologically responds to those stimuli, and the fact that your body does not know the difference between a fake scenario-based exercise in your mind and a real fight or flight experience, and how to best learn how to control your adrenaline and your cortisol in those situations. It's again, a captivating conversation. I am so thrilled that we had the opportunity to talk through both the spirituality side of things and also the power and the empowerment and the physicality that you can keep in mind when you are learning these tips and these techniques that Rachel teaches. I truly think that this is something that needs to be taught in elementary school to children of all genders, not just females, because it is something that as we go into college, as we go into the workforce, as we're traveling on crowded trains in New York or San Francisco, we do need to be mindful of things that matter to us, like body awareness and social distancing. And we talk a little bit about our aura bubble and what that actually means and how we can start teaching this to children and to teens and to young adults. And the majority of her programming currently is utilized for young adults that are already in college. So if this sounds like something that you absolutely want to learn more about and you are interested in figuring out a little bit of what we chatted about, including the spiritual and the physical side of empowerment, I encourage you to tune in and listen to this episode. Thank you so much for being here and get ready for Kylie Says.
Who's ready for season two?
So welcome to Kylie Says, Rachel.
I'm so excited to have you. I obviously heard about you and found out about you through the Sling and Stone and Method interview that Aaron hosted, and or maybe Daphne hosted. And frankly, I was just very impressed with everything that you were doing. I have a young daughter, and so hearing more about feminist self-defense, having never taken a class myself, but gone through bullying and all of these things, I felt like that would have been a critical thing for me to have learned. So thank you so much for being here. Can you tell us a bit about your background, your company, Feminist Self-Defense, and what it really stands for?
You're welcome. Yeah, totally. I'm so happy to be chatting with you today. Yeah, so I founded Feminist Self-Defense about 10 years ago. And I think my sort of journey to this world of self-defense is somewhat unique in that about 16 years ago, I started training Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And at the same time, I started a master's program for women's and gender studies. So both of these sort of niche interests that I was really exploring in a deeper way complemented each other, but were also sort of vastly different. You know, jiu-jitsu being a combat sport that at least historically has been very male dominated. And when I started training, I was the only woman at my jiu-jitsu school for about a year. So that was interesting in its own regard. But I was looking around, you know, exploring topics of gender equality, power, you know, how we feel power in our bodies, how we experience power in society based on, you know, our identity, our gender. And realizing that while the practice of jiu-jitsu could be incredibly empowering physically, that number one, that didn't always translate to, you know, being able to stand up for myself or speak up for myself. You know, while my confidence to like physically defend myself, you know, rose exponentially, I still was quite insecure and unable to, you know, really set a boundary with any sort of confidence or even know what my boundaries were. I also, during this time, saw how self-defense, you know, was taught from a very hyper-masculine within a patriarchal framework. And I knew early on that that was not right, that likely wasn't going to be effective. You know, I saw that the focus was mainly on stranger danger and sort of being afraid of this like scary other man who was going to, you know, jump out from behind the bush or attack you late at night. But in reality, the people that, you know, are most threatening to us oftentimes are the people we know, people who have a little bit of power, perhaps whether that's social power or, you know, and so while a lot of these sort of hyper-masculine self-defense instructors or whoever it is, meanwhile, but don't quite understand, you know, the vulnerabilities that targets of violence experience. And so I decided that, you know, combining my expertise and interests, that I thought I could do a better job. And so I started offering, so once I moved to New York City, and that was about 10 years ago, I started offering these pop-up self-defense classes in the park or at a friend's gym. And I just was like, wow, people really like this. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was just teaching, you know, some jiu-jitsu moves that I thought would be applicable to smaller people who might be experiencing or might be vulnerable to intimate partner violence or, you know, acquaintance violence. And people just really seemed to love it. And I noticed how thrilled they felt to kind of be able to accomplish some of these techniques, and they felt like really empowered in their bodies. And I thought, okay, well, people like this, let me keep on doing it. And so just organically over the last 10 years, my program has just expanded and grown. And I think more than anything, where I started teaching physical skills, I now see that the verbal boundary setting, the work that we connect and tune into our own bodies and know what our boundaries are, is really probably the most important part of the work that I do now. And it's really been in the process of teaching that, that I have also kind of gone on that journey of learning and teaching at the same time. So that's where, you know, that's where my approach is today.
Yeah, that's amazing. Congratulations. 10 years. That's super exciting.
I don't know where the time went, but yeah.
So you're also a professor. So how has what you have started with feminist self-defense translated into how you teach today and the topics that you teach and how this idea of utilizing self-defense as a form of empowerment changed throughout the course of your academic career?
Yeah. So, you know, my teaching has really become secondary to my teaching in the classroom has really become secondary to what I do day to day with feminist self-defense. And I think that more than anything, my teaching in the classroom, which is where I started, you know, first, has informed a lot of what I do in my workshops. So the comfort of speaking in front of a group of people, which is not always easy, even if you're used to it. But sort of that helped me to have a little bit more comfort in, you know, doing the feminist self-defense workshops and bringing sort of the academic feminism that is really where my passion for gender studies and gender equality really, you know, came to be, bringing that academic focus to my self-defense workshops. And while I'm teaching self-defense and focusing very much on each individual participant, sort of the idea is, you know, overarching social change. Yes, I want to help everybody in that room, but as we change our individual behavior, as we expand our understanding that what I experience when it comes to, you know, sexual violence, harassment, just feeling maybe not confident in my body is not a me problem, but it's an all of us problem. And, you know, really trying to expand our awareness and really create more overarching social change by teaching, you know, each individual. And so I really think of sort of my academic side informing my self-defense more than anything, I think.
What are some of the misconceptions that you find that your participants are surprised by when you're going through coursework? I guess coursework, I mean more as when you're going through the feminist self-defense overview and providing some statistics. What surprises people the most?
So I'll tell you, I try not to focus when I'm teaching my self-defense on statistics or things like of that nature, because I never want people to have more fear than what they walked in with. And so I will kind of, everything that I teach is designed to not get us dysregulated and more fearful, because, right, that's like, we want to, you know, when you think of self-defense, you think of like, okay, like X percentage of targets are, this is the type of violence they experience, blah, blah, blah. I try to keep everything pretty like, we know why we're here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I will focus on, because we do have the misconception that we're most at risk, you know, in public spaces. And that's just not the case. We are most at risk in private spaces with people we know. And those types of encounters don't necessarily look like what you see on the news, right? But what we see on the news is sort of what we inflate in our minds as our biggest risk. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't take away the fact that that is a risk, and our fear takes up a lot of space around that, right? Our fear limits us a lot. And so I think that's probably the misconception that a lot of people have, and just kind of reminding people without, because I also don't want people to be afraid around their friends, afraid around, you know, just, I want to decrease fear as much as possible. And so I think by focusing less on our vulnerability and more on our options is where I try to go with that.
I love that because I feel like obviously we hear about the fight or flight response when it comes to fear. And when you're going into something that may feel, oh my gosh, okay, am I going to learn this new skill and be able to protect myself if this ever happens to me? I love the fact that you don't focus on those statistics as much because they're available for anyone who's interested in looking them up.
That's right.
But what's not necessarily available is what you have to offer to them, which is the mindset shift that must go into what does it look like to set a boundary and then protect yourself against discomfort.
Totally. And, you know, the way I approach it is because people do come in very fearful of, or with the mindset of, I'm not capable of defending myself, right? That defending yourself means fighting physically against somebody who's larger than you. I start the physical self-defense aspects that I teach are as simple as turning a hug into a handshake or a fist bump or any type of touch that you want. So gaining your comfort with determining how your body is touched, and you're using your physical body to redirect somebody else's actions. And that's something that is socially awkward, but we utilize that to sort of flip that social script of, if somebody comes and gives you a hug, your arms sort of automatically mirror theirs. And so recognizing that and turning that into, no, this, we're going to handshake, or we're going to, I don't want to be touched. So I'm going to, you know, make that clear using my body. And so I think you start to rewire people's understanding of what it means to set a physical boundary and what it actually means to use your body in a way that protects you or creates the type of interaction that you want. Of course, as we go on, I teach, you know, skills that are a little bit more escalated and where you can see that even in a really vulnerable position, you still have a lot of options. Mm-hmm. But everything to kind of like, you know, we don't come in and there's like, you know, punching bags and this like environment of, you know, hypermasculinity or this really intimidating environment. It ends up like we start with a breathing meditation and talk about, you know, when we feel powerful. So everything to really kind of hone in on how everybody's uniquely powerful and how we actually have a lot of skills to protect ourselves, but oftentimes not the confidence or anybody who has shown us that it's okay. And we have a lifetime of socialization that, you know, wants us to sit back and allow whatever to happen.
What are some of the things that your students or participants will say when you're, should I say participants of the program, or do you,
that's the word I usually use.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you ask them what makes you feel powerful, do you allow them a chance to respond? I'm interested on what people say in this day and age makes them feel powerful.
Yeah. It's, I love this activity because I love hearing the answers. Mm-hmm. And I think I work a lot with college students. And so college students are oftentimes one step ahead of me, and they're, you know, really on it. And the idea of this question is to get people out of this version of power where we think of physical dominance or, you know, aggression or, you know, some sort of physical strength. And they're right on it. And they often tell me amazing things like people are dancers and they feel powerful when they're dancing, or they feel powerful when they make a really good point in an argument, or that they were right. And kind of speaks to this, you know, the sense, especially I think that students in college may experience, which is, you know, being in a classroom full of outspoken people, right? And the confidence it might take to get your point across or to volunteer to speak, which historically hasn't always been easy for women or gender expansive folks. I also, one thing that always comes up is some sort of article of clothing, usually a badass pair of shoes, boots, something that just makes people feel awesome when they put it on. And so it's really interesting to kind of hear those themes that arise. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people do feel powerful in their everyday lives. But there's this disconnect because we have been told that we're incredibly vulnerable physically. But once you give people a couple of strategies, they start to realize that that's maybe a myth, that they can be powerful physically as well.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's almost like without the reminder, you start to forget your internal story and you start to believe the external story because it's so much more prevalent. And you have to work on the internal story to say, I am powerful. I can use my voice as a boundary. I can use my body as a boundary. What are some of those boundary, like what physically, without being like, hi, y'all, get away from me. Like, what are some of those ways that you could say, if you're in an elevator and you feel like someone is too close to you, for instance, an older man is too close to you, like, what do you do?
I love these types of examples because I think it's the majority of what we experience, right? The majority of what we experience are these moments where we just feel like our agency gets kind of chipped away, right? Like my space is being taken, but I don't know how to handle this. So I just shrink. And you kind of feel yourself internally shrinking. I like to offer advice like make yourself bigger in those situations. So maybe it's a hand on your hip where the person is taking up space as a gentle reminder that I'm right here. And now maybe you're taking up their space and how do they respond to that, right? They may move away. Of course, I think we have oftentimes fear and oftentimes well-founded fear that when we begin to take up space, because society believes that maybe we're not entitled to that space, that there's, what's the backlash, right? Does that person then become agitated? Does that escalate a situation or make it more dangerous for us? And so I think that fear of that happening kind of keeps us from doing anything to, you know, counter that moment where we're feeling disempowered. And I always advise everybody, you know, I can tell you and I can give you tips, but you are ultimately the best judge in the situation of what's going to get you out of that situation safely. And so always sort of tune in and go with that gut feeling. And if you walk away and say, you know what, I wish I had taken up my space. Yeah, totally understand. But know that your body did what it had to do in that moment to allow you to, you know, get away unscathed. But yeah, I think little things just like taking up a little bit more space, or, you know, maybe even just like giving somebody a little bit of a acknowledgement, because we know oftentimes that somebody may not be doing it intentionally. It's a sort of socially acceptable behavior for some people to believe and to take up more space in the world. Mm-hmm. And they may not be consciously doing it. And so a little reminder might help you get that point across. And then you get to walk through the day feeling like at least you held your space.
And I think part of it also is just the awareness. I'm feeling uncomfortable. Instead of like, God, I got to get out of this freaking elevator. It's so crowded in here. It's like, this person is encroaching on my space. I'm aware of it and it's making me uncomfortable. And I'm going to respond by, like, one thing that I found I do is if I have a big purse or a backpack and I feel like someone is not disrespectfully, but maybe, or just uncomfortably in my space, let's say in an elevator, I will often remove my bag and pretend I'm looking for something in it and say like, I'm so sorry. Like I have to find this thing in my bag, and then like purposefully make more room for myself and be like, thank you so much. I'm so sorry. And it's like, it's me being extra polite, but it's also me saying, I need this space and you're going to have to move, without saying back up.
I think that's a beautiful example. And being from New York City and, you know, riding subways, that's similar to a tip that I would give people as well, right? If you have a bag, you can use that as a physical barrier. And I find that when you give people just sort of some ideas, they really take it and make it their own, you know, just like you did with, oh, now I'm looking through my bag and I'm taking up more space energetically too, right? Like I'm kind of owning this space, but I'm looking through my bag. I'm creating space around me. And I see that a lot with the participants in my program, right? Telling them, okay, here's something you can do, but make it your own. Make it something that feels right to you. And people have so much fun with it and making it kind of their version. And I think when you empower people to like, hey, you can do this, do it in a way that feels right. And people really flourish when they're given that permission, I think.
I would love to see data that would show, like, after college students go through your program, let's say 10 years down the line, it would be so awesome to be able to somehow quantify how they have de-escalated uncomfortable situations or created meaningful boundaries and how that served them in their ongoing careers, whatever those careers are. Because I feel like college is the age where you kind of have to either teach yourself through uncomfortable situations or things that you're like, I'm blocking that out of my memory because it pains me to know that my response was this, or I gave my way to this.
Mm.
And it can shape how you show up in the world as an adult, as a parent, as a coworker, as a wife, husband, whomever. But that would be so interesting. And it leads me to my question, which I guess is, as you look at who the participants of your program are, would you say that you are purposefully trying to reach that college age group because of the criticality that it holds and helping shape how they move through their life in the future? Or are there other groups? Is everyone a meaningful participant that could go through your program? Like, who are the people that you target?
Well, first, I think this content needs to reach people as young as possible. I think college is too late, frankly, because you're in college, you're put into these new situations and new dynamics, and everything is so impactful. And then all of a sudden, now you're supposed to be paying attention to, when do I feel comfortable? You know, the example that you gave of acknowledging that what's happening, thinking about what you can do about it, and then executing the plan. There's so much that goes on internally during that whole process. So, you know, we do need to be teaching young people. And I think, you know, this is happening more and more, but about what we're comfortable with in our bodies, you know, setting a boundary, what touch is okay. I know parents are doing that nowadays with their young children. But really, you know, I started going into universities because sexual violence on college campuses was such a well-known issue, and there was an infrastructure there to address it. So, you know, I think that working with college students is very valuable. I'm always interested and amazed and, you know, no longer surprised that people of all ages really respond to this work. Even people that you think that person is like a really like strong professional person, and I bet that they're great at setting boundaries, and some people really are, but this is very specific work. And unless you've done the very specific work, I often find that people are like, oh, this is really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's difficult. I think, I'm not sure with your group if we did the broken record method of setting a boundary.
Yes.
Right. But it's, you know, you set the boundary and then you just repeat it rather than giving a lot of excuses of why you have the boundary and changing your reasoning and apologizing a lot. You kind of just repeat it and end the interaction. And that's incredibly difficult for most people, no matter who they are and what age they are. And so I don't think, I think I'm, I, well, I'd love to work, you know, with everybody. And it's just a matter of, you know, what groups find me and who I end up working with. But every single time people bring something familiar and something new, and, yeah, there's just a lot of need.
Do you do, I mean, obviously because you did one with us, but I assume that you also can do like virtual workshops and that sort of thing. I have a few friends that are teachers of different grades, some high school, some middle school, some elementary school. And to me, I feel like at that age, kids are so curious to learn and they retain so much more than people give them credit for. I always feel like, why are we not teaching how to do taxes or do our mortgages when we're in high school? Why are we teaching calculus that you will likely not use unless you go into a trade school where you'll be incredibly mathematically inclined? Like, why are we not teaching self-defense and what boundaries look like in school? Why are we so focused on following a curriculum that is outdated and not relevant for how people interact in the world today? And I do a lot of spiritual work, and part of that is identifying energy, and energy cannot be destroyed. So, like, how do you then think about that? If someone is giving off energy to you that you are taking into your body, how are you then moving mm-hmm. that through you and getting rid of it? But also identifying that everyone has this aura, whether you can see it or not, but you can think about it as it goes 3 feet away from you in every single direction. So for kids, you're like, you have a bubble around you at all times, and it can change color based on your, if you're happy, if you're sad, if you're hurt. And if someone gets into your aura, you know, gets into your bubble, and you like are really paying attention to how they're feeling, how does that make you feel? And it's kind of like with adults, you have to be very aware and reminiscent of the fact that we all carry energy. And if you instinctually are feeling a negative energy or something is off, that is something that you are not wrong about. No matter what is actually happening outside, if you feel something is off, you have to then follow that cue and make a response both physically and energetically about how you're going to get out of that situation and then learn something from it to be able to teach and apply it elsewhere. I can imagine that as you're teaching some of these things, that would probably be quite rewarding to see that click happening with your students.
Well, I loved the little lesson that you just gave that you were pretending to give to an elementary school class. It's so on point. And I think that we are taught to dismiss our feelings, right? Our sort of gut feelings, because we're so in our brains, like in that logical part of our minds. And if it logically doesn't make sense, or if I've always gotten the message that it's my job to make people feel okay about themselves and less important for me to make myself feel okay, then I'm immediately going into the space of trying to sort of extend myself, and somebody else was mean, but what's wrong? How can I help you? And so taking on that energy, I suppose, and, you know, yeah, learning to trust that and trust that you can protect yourself, and you can do it without being mean if that's what you want. You know, I think that an important part of what I teach is being able to set that boundary and protect your energy bubble, as you put it, in a social situation with somebody that you like, or somebody that you don't necessarily, you know, self-defense doesn't mean if you've done something wrong to me and now I'm going to kick you in the groin. It's, oh, you put your arm around me and that felt weird, so I'm going to remove it or position my body so that you understand that that wasn't comfortable for me. And I can do it in a social setting that doesn't require me to be angry. It just can happen at any time that I'm protecting my energy and my boundaries.
Yeah, I find that I often used to use humor in uncomfortable situations. Like if someone would put an arm around me and I was uncomfortable, I'd be like, it's a no for me. And then be like, but we can stand next to each other and maybe shoulder to shoulder, And then like joke about it. But that still doesn't always, I'm comfortable making a joke about it because I don't fear confrontation. But for someone who fears confrontation, does not know how to set a boundary, cannot latch onto humor in uncomfortable situations because of that fear response. What are some of those like boundary, like how would you teach someone to set a physical boundary when they don't necessarily, like, I guess the biggest question is like, if you don't feel confident in saying anything, how do you do anything in that situation?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because I think we all have the ways that we feel more confident to set a boundary and ways that we feel less confident. Some people are much less confident to use their bodies to set a boundary. And some people are much actually less confident to speak up. I think I'm maybe because of my experience historically have been less confident to use my voice and more confident to use my body. And so it's important, I think, that people recognize where they're comfortable or where they're more comfortable and where they're less comfortable, right? And lean into those places that you are comfortable in the moment that, you know, is threatening or scary or that you need to kind of stand up for yourself in some way. But then build on where maybe you're less comfortable. And I think when we're doing these sessions and workshops with people, it's really repetition and practice and feeling yourself do it that starts to kind of like open that door for you. Because even when we're role playing a certain scenario and you know that this is completely make believe and we're just trying it out, it is still very difficult for people to even just practice it because the words coming out feel nearly impossible to say no, thank you, right? There's giggles and there's people who, you know, their nose are choked and they can't get it out, right? But through some repetition and feeling safer doing it. And I always recommend practicing these things with people you do feel safe around, whether it's just running through practice or whether it's, you know, implementing it in real life with somebody that, you know, there won't be huge repercussions or you won't feel, you know, and maybe, and it's also some people feel more comfortable setting a boundary with strangers. Mm-hmm. Some people feel more comfortable setting a boundary with someone, you know, so maybe it's, you know, where are you comfortable? Practice that and then start to expand it a little bit into other areas of your life. But I think that repetition and that practice is key because we're not going to do something when our adrenaline is running that we're not comfortable with. And so that's why, you know, really kind of working with people's comfort zone and then expanding it a little bit.
That's so, I love the idea of giving examples about if this, then that, but I think people so often don't even ask them that question. Like, how would you feel? Like, let me paint a scenario for you. And how would you feel? And what would you do? I think one of the answers people would probably say, I don't know. I don't know what I would do. I'm curious how I want to touch a little bit on your jujitsu background because I know of maybe one male friend who does jujitsu, but I don't know many people who do. I don't know like the philosophy behind it, how you move your body differently than traditional karate or MMA. Can you give us a bit of insight into what that is and how it really kind of helped frame this state of mind for you where you're like, this is something, not only do I need to teach from the physical, but then the mental aspect that goes into self-defense and awareness. What is like the philosophy behind jujitsu?
Sure. So, you know, I think one of the things that makes jujitsu particularly unique is, well, number one, it's a purely grappling sport. So there are no strikes. And it's a sport the grappling sport, you know, you do close up and it is in close proximity to another human the whole time, which I think lends itself well to intimate partner violence, acquaintance violence, or even just, you know, situations where you need to set a boundary with somebody that you know who's already sort of close to you physically. And the other super cool thing about jiu-jitsu is that it allows you to be offensive from the ground and on your back. So a position that would anybody looking at it could say, well, that's a really vulnerable place to be. What could you possibly do from there? And jiu-jitsu shows you, you can do a whole heck of a lot from there. So, you know, in the sport of jiu-jitsu or even jiu-jitsu itself as self-defense, the goal is to end the fight with a submission being a choke or a joint lock. And so you essentially make somebody tap out because if you continue to go, it's going to be very uncomfortable or bad for them. And so also that jiu-jitsu is really designed for a smaller or weaker person to be able to physically overcome a larger person using leverage, momentum. You know, good jiu-jitsu is jiu-jitsu that you don't have to force. It doesn't require as much physical force and strength. It's about using those moments and opportunities to your advantage, using somebody else's body weight to your advantage. And it's very technique driven. That, I think, is the main, you know, application and what I've brought to feminist self-defense. This idea that you do not have to be big and powerful in order to physically control another person's body. That technique, knowing a little bit of know-how, can overcome a lot. But also recognizing where jiu-jitsu and the physical self-defense aspect falls short. That, and you spoke, you mentioned data earlier. You know, that 10 years down the road data from my program, I would love to see, and I don't have. But what we do know is that empowerment self-defense programs like mine, so I follow the empowerment self-defense model, show that participants of these programs are less likely to experience an assault attempt. So they are more likely, if they are assaulted, to be able to escape. But what's kind of the most exciting prospect of that is that they're less likely to experience an assault attempt. So it's not that, you know, the physical self-defense part of it, they were able to fight somebody off. It's that they're in tuned enough, have enough tangible skills with the boundary setting, verbal boundary setting, or even the physical boundary setting, and being able to have the confidence to know that I have a boundary and I can back that up, that they're just not even being traumatized with an assault attempt. And so that's where, you know, the physical self-defense aspect and the so that's where the physical self-defense aspect added to the verbal boundary setting, added to sort of being able to tune in and recognize when your body is telling you that you don't feel safe or that something's wrong, kind of really come together to create this sort of magic, protective magic for us. Yeah. And so every element of that is, I think, essential in this equation.
How does breathing come into play with a primarily skill-based form of combat versus a strength-based form of combat?
That's such an interesting question.
I'm just curious because, I mean, I don't know the statistics around this, but when you go into this adrenaline state, you're breathing faster, your heart is beating quicker. So it's not like you can be taking a meditative breath before you make some sort of a strategic decision in that experience of, you know, if an assault is imminent or you are fearful that there may be the prevalence of violence or discomfort. So you mentioned, like, I start my sessions with a breathing exercise. I can imagine that even being able to identify what those physical cues are of my heart is beating fast, I'm nervous, I'm scared, my head feels like all the blood is rushing to my head. You don't have time to think about all those things in this situation where you'll have an immediate response. So that was more just curiosity to me about the importance of recognizing breath and how you can utilize it for power in general, because I don't feel like that much either.
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting approach. So with the sort of the context of your question, it's interesting because the breathing exercise that I do in the beginning, I really have people kind of come into their bodies by taking some breaths and, you know, kind of just grounding themselves in that moment. But I ask people to bring up something in their minds that they don't like, something that gets on their nerves, not something that's too overwhelming, but just something that they don't like that elicits a reaction. And then I ask them to notice any sensations that they feel in their body. So when they come out of it, people notice a lot of things, right? A lot of sensations, right? So just like you were saying, you know, like just a little bit of activation that imagining something that you don't like happening, right? So, oh, my stomach clenched, my shoulders came up to my ears. Mm-hmm. I felt a fire or a burning in my chest. My hands got sweaty. And people have so many different physiological responses to just imagining something happening that they don't like. And so really what I'm at, you know, getting people to get into the practice of is noticing how your body responds without you having to think about it really. But I think, you know, we ignore all of the ways that our bodies are talking to us most of the time, right? We want them to just behave and move on with, you know, what we had intended for that day. So shut up. I'm going to ignore the fact that I've got this nagging stomach ache and just keep on doing what I'm doing, right? But what are our bodies telling us? And so, you know, really then the practice is to be so far ahead of somebody pushing your boundary, right? Of course, we don't have all, number one, we do not have control over somebody else's actions. So I want to make that clear, right? So we don't have control of what somebody else does. We absolutely can be caught off guard. And if we don't respond to something that happens to us the way that we wish we had, not our fault, right? We're doing the best for ourselves that we can in a world that is messed up. But expanding our practice so that we can sort of just the smallest inkling that something's not right, sort of already start setting a boundary around it, right? That's not something I want to be close to. I know I noticed that and I want to keep space from that because I'm protecting this bubble, this energy bubble around me, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we notice that, but way before something happens that's, you know, increasingly harmful, then we can keep ourselves way safer, right? Or way safeguard our well-being much more easily. But that practice of like being able to sense things that are going around us and acknowledge it and notice it and then create a strategy on how to set a boundary around it is hard work.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I feel like when you talk more directly about boundary setting, it also comes to, it's a psychological safety thing about what do you feel you deserve? Do you deserve to feel safe? Why do you deserve to feel safe? Do you deserve to set a boundary? Do you deserve to value someone else's comfort over your own? That then becomes something where it's almost like, if I think about my bubble, I think about, okay, if I have these post-it notes on it that are things that I allow inside my bubble versus the ones that I want outside of my bubble, like what do I allow inside my bubble? You know, it's like love, friendship, psychological safety, physical safety, camaraderie, vulnerability. And then the things that are outside of it are like, you know, aggression, discomfort, you know, like fear, those sorts of things that it's like, if it comes inside, it feels uncomfortable. And I can set the boundary. I don't need to stay in this situation if I am feeling unsafe, even if it will hurt someone's feelings. Because their bubble is not my bubble and I'm not taking their bubble with me. I'm only taking my bubble with me. So like, I think that the idea of, or I love that the idea of what you like, what I deserve, what do I need? It comes back to kind of this idea at the end of the day of self-love, of when you have self-love, then you also can create self-respect. And what do you think about when you think of respect? Do you think of, how do I nurture this person's feelings, emotional well-being, physical well-being, give them create this boundary? Like all of that to me feels very aligned with how you have to coach someone to learn what it means to create a boundary and have some self-respect and know that they're worthy of, it's like the Maybelline thing. Maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's, you know, a mindset shift that like can help you evaluate how you operate throughout the world, because you do deserve to feel safe in every situation that you're in. And if you don't, you do deserve to remove yourself and create a new sense of safety and create a new boundary. Like all of those things I think are so important. I'm just thinking about like, how do I teach that little gal to do that? How do I teach this little guy to be mindful of that?
And in this work, we're undoing decades of the opposite, you know, people,
generations of it.
Exactly. Of feeling not deserving of your own comfort and safety, preferring that the person who's interacting with you feels better and that you can somehow have the capacity to pile on all of the discomfort. So that, I mean, that's a huge, huge task. But I also love to close my sessions with the same meditative exercise, but instead of thinking something that you don't like, you think of feeling safe and at ease. And so how does your body respond when you think of or imagine feeling safe and at ease? And that's a completely different experience, right? And so our shoulders drop. People say, well, I feel a little smile on my face. You know, I feel my breathing got smoother and easier. And so how do we let those signals that our body sends us inform our boundaries, right? Because a boundary isn't just keeping out what you don't want, as you mentioned, right? It's noticing what you do want, what does make you feel safe, what makes you feel energized, and what makes you feel fulfilled. And, you know, that interplay of protecting that space and keeping in the things that you want near. And so kind of really bookending my session with this letting your body guide you,
mm-hmm.
and showing you what's feels good and what doesn't.
I love that. I feel like that's a great place for us to stop for today. We went full circle. As people are looking at, like, if people want more information, they want to reach out, they want to find you, where are all of the places that they can do that and find more information?
Yeah. So on Instagram, feminist at feminist self-defense. My website is feministselfdefense.com. There, my email is booking@feministselfdefense.com. You can DM me on Instagram. There's a form to email me on my website. I'm on TikTok, but don't know really how to use that. So maybe that's not your best bet, but yeah.
Okay. Well, this was so informative and a welcome discussion. I think that so many people are going to find value from. So thank you again so much for giving us your time and energy. And
this was so fun to talk with you about. Yeah. And I think it's so interesting to hear, you know, the complimentary perspective that you have coming from a more sort of spiritual perspective and how that kind of crosses over with what I do. So I love that.
Yeah. Maybe one day we'll do a joint thing.
Yes, we'll totally do it.
And how it intrinsically links you to your power and yes. Character. You got something there.
I love it.
Okay, well, again, thank you so much.
Thank you.